Welcome back to the program. Young women today are succeeding at geometric rates. The number of young women graduating from college, from law schools and graduate schools is far outstripping young men. Women are succeeding in a remarkable range of careers, including politics and corporate boardrooms, heretofore places built with the proverbial glass ceiling. Yet paralleling all of this is a culture that encourages young girls to wrap themselves in the pink accoutrements of ultra-feminine, girly, princess culture, and then, later, to enter a culture of extreme sexualization. How can all of these facts be true at the same time? What's happening that creates this apparent contradiction in the lives of young women? To try and pull all of this together, I'm joined by a guest that has been with us before. It is a pleasure to welcome Peggy Ornstein back to this program. Peggy is the author of the best-selling memoir, Waiting for Daisy. She's also the author of Flux and Schoolgirls. Her work has appeared in numerous publications, including the New York Times Magazine. It is my pleasure to welcome Peggy Ornstein back to the program to talk about her latest work, Cinderella Ate My Daughter, Dispatches from the Front Lines of the New Girly Culture. Peggy Ornstein, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me back, Jeff.
Great to have you. This whole project kind of started out as a result of an article, an essay that you did for the New York Times Magazine that garnered tremendous reaction, I think reaction that surprised everybody, including you.
Oh, yeah. I was really surprised. I had written an essay when my daughter turned three about her obsession with the Disney princesses, which sort of came out of left field. I had never heard of a Disney princess. I didn't, you know, it's something she came home from preschool with. And I had noticed increasingly that this particular princess fantasy was dominating all the girls' play. So when I went to her preschool and the kids had done this project where they had filled in a blank for a sentence and then drawn a picture. So the sentence was, if I were a blank, I'd blank to the store. And you could fill it in with, like, if I were a ball, I'd roll to the store. And the boys had done all, you know, they had done superheroes and Lightning McQueen, but they had also done puppies and raisins and bugs and all kinds of different things. And the girls had done princesses, ballerinas, fairies, and butterflies. And that was it. And the teacher, I talked to the teacher about it, she said she had been really surprised and, you know, tried to get the girls to do something else, and they wouldn't. This was sort of a new thing that she had observed. And sort of thinking about all this and kind of the rise of princess and pink, which I didn't remember from being a kid, I went off to explore it and ended up writing about it in the Times. And, yeah, it shot to the top of the most emailed list, along with the crisis in the Middle East, and, you know, and stayed there for days. And I just thought, wow, I had no idea that this was such a, you know, half the mail to me was, you know, hallelujah, somebody's talking about this, and half of it was, you're un-American and a terrible mother. And I thought, I've really touched a nerve here, because, you know, girls don't, most of them don't go to college in their princess dresses, but, nice. You know, but there's something about the culture right now that's going on that I need to look at more.
And what were your own preconceptions about this going in? What did you think was at play here that we had women, young women, doing so well on one hand in terms of colleges, in terms of graduate schools, all the things that I had mentioned in the introduction, and yet there was this pervasive and growing culture, this girly culture that you're talking about?
Yeah, I found that very intriguing and confusing, and I didn't really quite know what to make of it, except that I was seeing that this culture that was encouraging girls to define themselves through appearance and play sexiness, growing stronger and younger. And it seemed almost as if, almost as if one had somehow created the other, that somehow even as girls were doing better, they felt compelled to go further down this other road, and that the girl power that we had talked about in the 1990s, that was about independence and self-sufficiency and the freedom from defining yourself through the body beautiful, had become its own opposite, so that now it was the freedom to define yourself through the pursuit of the body beautiful, but that the line between get to and have to was getting really blurry.
Later on, it would become a kind of, or be perceived as kind of a sexual empowerment. But the fact that it started so young, and that you saw girls as young as, you know, 2 years old, sort of embracing this culture.
Yeah, one guiding principle for me as a parent that I brought out of doing this work was disentangling sexuality from sexualization, because I think that it's confusing. I'm confused as a parent, and in this book I'm very clear about being, you know, a fellow traveler with all my foibles and inconsistencies and hypocrisies and, you know, wrestlings with all of this, just like we all do, with where to draw the line and what's okay and what's not. But so sexuality is something that we want to cultivate in our girls over time, that rises from within and connects them to their own desire and allows them to, you know when, how to say no, when they can say no, how to say yes, when to say no. Yes, gives them sort of, you know, the power of their own sexuality. And sexualization is the performance of sexuality for others. Its emphasis is on being desirable over your own desire, on defining yourself through how you believe you look to other people rather than how you feel inside of yourself. And that kind of helped me as I was going through figure out what was going on here. And so, you know, it's easy also for one thing to become another. So little girls, like, I don't know if you saw this, but there's a new line of makeup that just came out from Walmart for 8 to 12-year-old girls. Did you see that?
No.
Yeah, and Target has one too, as does Bonnie Bell. And what they said was that little girls wear clear lip gloss and nail polish when they're 2 or 3, and so that by 8, they naturally want a little enhancement. And, you know, I don't know if you have a little girl, but I have a second grader, and I really don't want her worrying about whether her concealer is in place when she's out on the playground. But it's sort of that compression that I was looking at, that these issues, if we were talking about them 10 or 15 years ago, we would be talking about, you know, 12 or 13-year-old girls, and now we're talking about 3, 4, 5, 6-year-old girls.
Which raises the kind of chicken or egg question, whether it is just the result of marketing efforts that are directed at these girls by the cosmetic industry, by Disney, etc., or whether there's something in the culture that is making it easier for these marketers to sell these products to these young girls.
Well, that's a really big question. I don't know if I can answer that, but there's certainly, we live in a culture right now, you know, one thing that the book is about to a large degree is the performance culture, mm-hmm. and the ways that girls learn to perform sexuality, perform identity, perform femininity. And I think all of us to a degree have become more focused on image and performance as we've become creatures of social media, where we, you know, we process our experience as we go through it, and all this. So I do think that we're, you know, we're in a very performance-oriented culture, and maybe to a degree this is how it's affecting girls.
There's also the compression that you were talking about before in terms of the age at which young girls engage in these various activities. I mean, you talk about the age, you know, for Barbies even, that it mm-hmm. used to start at, what, 8, 9 years old? Now it starts at about 3.
Yeah, 9 to 12 was the original demographic for Barbie, and now it's 3 to 5. And that's what marketers call that, kids getting older, younger, so that products tend to start with an older group, and then younger kids, in an effort to sort of be like their big brothers and sisters, start reaching up towards them, and then the older kids don't want them anymore. So things tend to migrate downward that way.
And as they age out of those things earlier, they're looking for other things to replace them with.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, you know, when girls are right now, now, of course, people send me millions of examples of this all the time. I'm not sure if it's to help me or to irritate me. Like yesterday, somebody sent me a link to this a chain store called Sweet and Sassy, which is similar to a store called Libby Lou that I write about mm-hmm. in the book that has subsequently closed. But this is the same thing. It does spa makeover diva parties for 4-year-olds, and they pick you up, you and your friends up in your in their pink limo and take you to the mall and, you know, do your hair and your makeup and everything. And you do wonder, gee, if you're doing that at 4, what are you going to be doing at 12?
Then the other question becomes, is there any harm in this? What is the consequence of all of this?
Right. Well, I think, you know, there's a number of things. You know, first of all, the American Psychological Association put out a report a few years ago saying that the sexualization, early sexualization of little girls, and by that I don't mean them becoming sexual so much as acting out sexiness or playing with toys like Bratz dolls and such that sort of encourage that, or that focus on appearance, even, you know, in a less overt or less, Bratz dolls, trashy,
right.
can make girls vulnerable, can increase girls' vulnerability to the things that we parents worry about, you know, negative body image, eating disorders, depression, poor sexual choices, and that by middle school, half of the differential between depressed and non-depressed girls can be attributed to self-objectification, to seeing yourself and judging yourself as you believe others see and judge you. So that's pretty significant. And, you know, beyond that, and not that you need to be on that, but when girls are urged or encouraged or not protected from acting out, you know, sassiness, or which is what you call it with little girls, or sexiness too early, it rather than connecting them to their sexuality, because they don't understand it, because it's a concept that's over their heads, I mean, thank goodness they don't understand it, but it disconnects them from their healthy sexuality and puts them on the road to not being able to connect acting sexy and performing sexiness with their inner erotic life. And that, you know, over the, I just don't think we want that for our daughters. And so, you know, we've been sort of convinced that we don't have more choices for them right now. And I just wanted to put this out there so that people would think about it, think about the kind of, you know, arc of it, and also think about what else they could give their daughter that would expand her sense of her femininity rather than narrow it down.
Has this been going on long enough? Has this been part of the culture long enough that we have really begun to see the results in some of the ways that you're talking about, as these young girls have gone off to college and then, you know, beginning careers, and how they've dealt with sexual issues?
Well, you know, this really intense thing that's been happening with little girls is only about 10 years old. So you wouldn't have adults that have experienced this. But we are seeing a rise in concern. There was a large-scale survey done of elementary school-age girls. And since between 2000 and 2006, there was a significant rise in their concern about body and weight issues as opposed to concern about their schoolwork, which went down. So that kind of dovetail with the rise of this phenomenon. And meanwhile, a market research group did a survey that said almost half of six-year-olds regularly wear lip gloss or lipstick, and the percentage of 8 to 12-year-olds who are wearing eyeliner and mascara has doubled since 2008. So I think all of that reinforces the idea that, you know, that there's an emphasis on appearance, and also that the emphasis on appearance has consequences.
The other question is whether the emphasis on appearance and doing this for appearance, particularly among girls this young, you wonder what their reasoning is. Why do they think they're doing it? Are they doing it to impress other girls? Are they doing it to impress young boys? What is behind that?
They're doing it because it's fun. Who doesn't like sparkles? Come on. You know, and the sparkles are not the problem. It's the constant 24/7, 300, you know, it's what has risen up and almost normalized is this idea. So, you know, if you take the color pink, we think that pink is like girls are like heat-seeking missiles, right? They just, like, go for pink. They can't resist pink. It's, like, in their DNA, the pink thing. But it turns out that that's a relatively new phenomenon, and that when pink and blue, you know, everybody wore white. In 100 years ago, there was no Maytag. All babies wore white, and you boiled everything to get it clean. So there were no colors. Then colors came in, pink and blue, and pink was assigned to boys because it was a pastel version of red, which connoted strength and masculinity. And blue was assigned to girls because it was thought of as being associated with constancy and faithfulness in the Virgin Mary. So even in the 1930s, a department store in New York did a survey that and found that 25% of its customer base still associated pink with boys and blue with girls, which, you know, not the majority, but I don't think you get 1% today that said that. Even somebody sent me a picture of Michael Reagan in the 1960s wearing an all-pink suit. So, you know, I mean, I don't, not to mention, you know, there's the whole communism thing there. I don't know what that was about. But, you know, I can't imagine that if Ronald Reagan were alive today and a father, that he would dress his son in an all-pink suit.
Right.
So there's this way that it wasn't until really the 1980s that pink really came into its own. I mean, I'm sure when you were a child, I know when I was a child, I didn't dress in pink all the time. My mom actually dressed me in blue because I had blue eyes.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is sort of a relatively new thing, and people sort of, you know, think it's always been thus, and that's kind of what happens with these trends.
What does the socioeconomic trend tell us in this? Is this something that is happening across the socioeconomic spectrum, or are we seeing it more in some groups as opposed to others?
No, it's pretty much across the board. I mean, it's very hard. For one thing, good luck going into a store and getting something else. I mean, I don't care if you walk into Pottery Barn Kids or a Walmart or anywhere in between. You know, it's like apartheid in those stores now. It's, you know, the girl aisle, the boy aisle, whether you're talking about toys or clothing or bedding. And having said that, I don't want to indicate that I think that the flip side or the response should be neutrality. Although, you know, some neutral, you know, all kids play with blocks, whatever. That's not, you know, that's the kind of 70s solution to to hyper-gendered worlds. And I think it's misguided because when they're, particularly when they're in preschool, girls and boys have a deep developmental need to assert themselves as girls and boys. So they need, because they don't understand the whole, like, anatomy business, and so as far as they're concerned, you could grow up to be a mommy or a daddy, and the thing that makes you a girl is wearing barrettes, and the thing that makes you a boy is, you know, I don't know, it can be anything. They can do it with, you know, boys eat apples, girls eat oranges, or, you know, they'll do it with anything. And that's why you can't stuff your three-year-old into pants, no matter, your three-year-old daughter, no matter, you know, what you do. You can be raising her in a box, and suddenly when she's three, she'll, you know, refuse to get into pants, because they need to do that. So the issue, the flip side is not to, you know, refuse to acknowledge that, but to acknowledge it with something that maybe promotes a healthier, airier, less appearance-driven, less consumer-driven idea of what it could mean to her to be feminine.
The other extension of this appearance-driven culture, as you talk about, is the degree to which it creates a kind of self-centeredness in a lot of these girls.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And with girls, that's a really, I'm really glad you brought that up. That's a really big turn that the princess culture, or what I guess I'm calling now the princess industrial complex, does, is that, you know, so my daughter, you know, got into this princess thing. She was actually pretty brief with it. But then so by the time she was seven, you're supposed to be done with that little girl princess thing. You wouldn't touch it, right? But for her birthday that year, she got a make-your-own messenger bag kit. And it had, you know, like all these, you know, iron-on transfers of hearts and flowers and that kind of thing. And then it had transfers that said spoiled, brat, and pampered princess. Mm. And she looked at those and said, Mom, why would anybody put that on their purse? To which I thought, yeah. But I think there's this way that, and again, you know, I mean, it's a sort of, you know, Paris Hiltonization, Kim Kardashianization of the culture, but that I call it girls power with a Z, like brats with a Z and Thai girls with a Z. And it's this notion that, the independence and the sort of self-sufficiency and the agency that we were thinking about in the 90s for girls is now their power, instead of being expressed by deed or action, is expressed through narcissism and materialism. So the way that you say you're a powerful female is to, you know, have spoiled on your purse or wear the pink shirt with the crown that says, give me the credit card, nobody gets hurt. And it's a really kind of, I mean, in a theoretical way, in an analytical way, it's really interesting. You know, as a mom, I'm not so excited about it.
It's also created this kind of empathy gap.
Yeah, there has been a significant, this is for boys and for girls, this is not exclusive to one sex, but since, in the, let's see, 1970, I think, there has been a steady rise in rates of narcissism in large-scale studies of college students, particularly going up in the last 10 years, and simultaneously a drop in empathy. And so there's something about the way that we are raising our children or about what they're experiencing in the world or what the culture they're partaking of, that is increasing their self-centeredness and lowering their compassion.
And as they start to have relationships or interact with boys as they get into high school, what are we seeing in terms of how all of this is impacting the nature of those relationships?
Well, I'll tell you, I mean, I'd like to go back for a second to little kids to answer that.
Sure.
For a minute, which is that before I said that girls and boys really need to be girls and boys, and that's true, and they will also naturally, you know, much as my feminist foremothers may hate to hear it, they will naturally gravitate towards, you know, girls towards things with faces and boys towards things that roll and that, you know, stereotypical toys at that age. It's one of the biggest sex differences across the lifespan is toy choice in preschool. Even monkeys do it. So, you know, that's those things are true. At the same time, their brains are the most plastic at that time, the most malleable. So they're laying down lifelong tracks intellectually, behaviorally, and cross-sex play during that era is crucial. So that, for instance, girls with older brothers tend to have better spatial skills than girls with older sisters or boys with older sisters. Boys from egalitarian families tend to be more nurturing as they get older than boys from less egalitarian families. So so that contact with people of the other sex changes their brains and changes them long term. And it's really important in the preschool years. But when your daughter is sitting there in her pink room, in her pink princess dress, with her pinkalicious book, having her pink princess party and her spa makeover and the whole thing, it is very hard for those moments of cross-sex play to happen. And one of the impacts of cross-sex play in the preschool and elementary school years is that children who play with kids of the other sex have better dating relationships in high school and beyond than children who don't, because they're less alienated. You know, they have experience with the other sex. So cognitively, psychologically, emotionally, that's really important. And that all was brand new to me in my reporting and has really changed how I parent.
And so girls from larger mixed families where they might be more brothers and sisters, particularly brothers, are arguably going to do a little better in this regard. And the smaller families that we're seeing more of in a lot of places today create more of this potential problem.
Well, I don't know about the size of the family, and it's a very specific effect because it doesn't go from younger child to older child.
Uh-huh.
So if a girl has a younger brother, that's not going to affect her cognitively. I don't know if it affects her in terms of her relationships. And even twins, you don't see it so much. So it's definitely the dominance of the older child that has the effect, which is pretty interesting. So. So I don't know that family size would have much to do with it so much as birth order. But again, when kids, you don't need to have a large family for that. If kids are playing with, you know, even in, I talk about this curriculum where they found even little things like when preschool teachers comment positively on girls and boys interacting, they do it more.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so, I mean, preschoolers are kind of easy that way. So anything that encourages girls and boys to play together, you know, again, naturally they will gravitate more towards their own sex. That's just the way it is. But there's plenty of time when they play together. And whenever that's encouraged, it's really healthy for kids.
One has to wonder about what the lower age limits are of some of this. I mean, if we're seeing girls with eyeliner at 6, 7, 8 years old, where does it go from there?
Well, I'll tell you. I don't know if you saw this, but Disney, I just wrote something about this actually that's on the NPR web, the national NPR website. Disney has launched a new campaign based on the model of the success of the Disney princesses, which I don't think I mentioned has become a $4 billion a year industry with over 26,000 products. So it's, you know, it is a mega success. And based on that, they are trying to now go for the one area of childhood where they have not conquered and dominated, which is the 0 to 3-year-old set. And they have launched a new program in which they're going into maternity wards to go into the hospital rooms of women just after they've given birth and offer them a free branded Disney onesie. So, you know, maybe like a princess or Simba the Lion or whatever, if they sign up for the Disney Baby email list. And they're viewing this as a beachhead for, that's their word, for a whole line of products, like the princess products, that will sort of make it possible for you to have every aspect of your baby you know, in the Disney baby line. So how low can it go? Apparently it can go to the womb.
And then,
I'm hoping actually that I was going to tell them they should make a Snow White coffin. so they could go right. So they could go the whole way. That would be there's also Disney princess wedding dresses for grown-ups. Yeah. Like you can get married in, you know, your Cinderella Disney princess wedding dress.
It's interesting. One of the gaps that they've left out, which has been filled, and you talk about it in the book, is sort of after they age out of some of the early Disney stuff and the Barbie stuff, is the whole American Girl experience.
Yeah, well, they are they address that in a couple ways, but the American Girl is fascinating to me. I mean, there's a lot to recommend American Girl, like the books. I think the books are fine, and it's interesting in the books because the girls in the books, in a strange way, seem more liberated than contemporary girls, even though they're historical, so they live in times of, you know, political oppression, or you know, women can't vote, or they can't own property, or they can't do various jobs, or whatever. But they are always judged by character and by deed, and that's how they judge themselves. And they never are commented on or judge themselves by the way that they look. And I compare the description of an American girl's description of her goals with a Bratz character's description of her goals, which is geared towards the same age group.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really striking. You know, that said, the American Girl dolls in the books could not afford themselves if they went into the store. So there's, American Girl is very expensive.
Right.
I've tried to avoid it. I don't want to put out that kind of money for a doll. But the value, I wish there were a less expensive way to promote good values, and it does have this sort of other side of, in the process, promoting a kind of consumerism and bonding, shopping as the way to bond between mother, the stores, shopping as a way to bond between mother and daughter. I took a friend and her daughter to the store to sort of report on it because I didn't want to take my own daughter because she didn't know about it then and I didn't want her to.
And then, of course, is the way that this is playing out in the popular culture, in social networking, and also in music, and whether it's Lady Gaga or Miley Cyrus, all are in some ways a reflection of what we're seeing here.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that the what you're supposed to grow into from the Disney princesses is the Disney flesh and blood princesses, right? The Disney Channel girls like Miley Cyrus or Demi Lovato or Lindsay Lohan or, you know, the whole Britney Spears was a Disney girl.
Right.
I think that in their trajectory, you really see a lot of what's going on, which is that when they first come out, they're marketed as role models. And they wear true love waits rings, promise rings, and which mean that you're supposed to stay a virgin until you're married. And they say things like, I want to pick clothes that moms love and that girls love too, or moms approve of and girls love, and I look way young and I want to stay that way. And then, you know, 3 months later they're dancing on a stripper pole. And it's that, you know, I don't know that you can commodify and make wholesomeness into a marketing gimmick without doing the same with what comes after. And that flip is again this, you know, you go from projecting and performing this wholesomeness to projecting to sexualization, and that's the flip our girls see, and it's just, you know, it's not the best image.
Will there be, finally, do you think, a pushback against this at some point? As you've been out there talking about Cinderella Ate My Daughter and talking to mothers about this, do you see a potential pushback coming?
I really do, and that is what's exciting to me. I mean, the book last week was number 13 on the New York Times bestseller list, so I think that's a good sign that people are interested in the conversation. It's gotten tremendously positive response, and I think, you know, and I've also, just so you know, I've put up a resource list on my website, which is just peggyornstein.com, that, is a list of things that you might want to give your daughter that can expand her ideas of what it means to be a girl when she's little. But I sort of, you know, what I think of it is that parents are kind of fed up, and I use that term because I think we tend to talk about media and playthings and such as what our kids consume. And I think the food analogy is a good one because 10 years ago, if we were talking about food, you know, who knew what trans fat was and who cared if your chicken was in a cage or not before you ate it, right?
Mm-hmm.
But because of a couple of books that started the conversation, Omnivore's Dilemma and Fast Food Nation, books like that, people started talking about this issue, the food issue, all over the country. And while we still have an obesity epidemic and there's lots of people who still, you know, couldn't care less, a lot of people do care, and a lot of people did take action from, you know, a micro level of farmers markets to the macro level of changing school lunch programs in Congress and McDonald's offering healthy menus. And I think as parents, if we could make McDonald's blink, we can make Mattel blink.
Peggy Ornstein, the book is Cinderella Ate My Daughter, Dispatches from the Front Lines of the New Girly Girl Culture. Peggy, I thank you so much for spending time with us.
Oh, it's always a pleasure, Jeff. Thank you.
Thank you.